CliffCentral.com. It is time for This Is Us, and this week Lebang Khosana and I are going to take some time to find real solutions as to how we can make South Africa an amazing place. We believe it's an amazing place. We believe in this country. We have lots to be very proud of in South Africa, but we have enormous challenges. Mm. And each of those challenges creates an opportunity. And part of the reason that we are doing this is because we want to find those solutions by talking to the good and the great and the people who've spent an enormous amount of time and energy trying to find those solutions. We have such a person here today. His name, of course, is well known to many South Africans, but just in case you weren't paying attention, or you were asleep under a rock, or you've been comatose for a long time, Professor Bonang Mohale is the Chancellor of the University of the Free State. He's also a Professor of Practice at the Johannesburg Business School, Chairman of both the Bidvest Group Limited and SBV Services. He's the President of Business Unity South Africa, which is an enormous and powerful organization that has representation at NEDLAC, no less. Mm. He's also the CEO, formerly, of Business Leadership South Africa and the past president of the Black Management Forum. His new book is called Behold the Turtle, and it is a great pleasure. Prof. Lebang, Prof. Bonang.
Actually, it means the same thing, yeah, ironically. So you're lucky. Bonang, Lebang, there it's we go. The same thing.
So Bonang, it's very good to see you again, sir.
Thank you for having me, my dear brother, Limme Lebang.
Hey. No, so I think the real reason why it's so important for us to have you here today is just to, you know, unpack This Is Us, and This Is Us as a concept post the riots last year that we saw. You know, the country was just all over the place, and KZN and Gauteng were obviously hurt the most, but most importantly, after that, we saw the country coming together. You know, there was this opportunity, and South Africans showed a different side of them. And this is about that. It's about focusing on the good that we can do, focusing on seeing the country come together. And you are one of the people that, I guess, effortlessly does that. So it's important for us to have you here.
And Prof, you know, you're very realistic. You're a man who does the research. You can see the wood for the trees. Your book certainly lays out, and I spoke to you about this briefly last year, some of the chief challenges for South Africa. But I want to start off with a hard question and ask you, in your view, where and how did we fail as a nation to achieve the deeply felt reconciliation? There's no doubt that post-1994, there was an enormous wellspring of moral high ground, of enthusiasm, of patriotism. All of that seems to have dwindled in 27 years. And I want to know what you think the reason for that is.
I genuinely believe that the reason why we have squandered the goodwill, enormous goodwill that was vested in us on the 27th of April 1994, when we ushered in our first democratically elected president, Rolihlahla Nelson Mandela, is that we became greedy. Mm. And greed is more than just having enough for yourself. It says you are not satisfied until and unless you are called the first African billionaire in South Africa. Dollars, not just rents. It says you are not satisfied until you see yourself parking 21 cars in your garage or many garages in Sandton because you bought it with ill-gotten gains. Mm. It says you're not satisfied until you can show it off. When you go to Konka and you park a Porsche Cayenne here and you still have an X5M at home. Mm. And yet we know that nature says it will look very askance. Scientists will study a monkey that holds all the bananas to itself without sharing with others, because the very survival of that species, the existential challenge they are facing is to be together. Because when they are together, the one on top of the tree can say, I can see the lion approaching. The one at the bottom can say, but there's also a leopard below here. And then the silverbacks can say, when this danger is all done, there are millifields to our right, we can eat to our satisfaction. And yet human beings have forgotten that notion of Ubuntu. So when you hoard only to yourself, we put you on the cover of Forbes magazine. That's not genuinely human. That's not Ubuntu. So as I end, I think this word called state capture has totally devastated us and the economy. It took out a third out of the national GDP, and state capture is worse than corruption, because corruption is opportunistic, it's incidental. State capture is both systemic and systematic. Cliff.
Sure. So, Prof Banang, one of the things that, firstly, I'm a huge fan of the book. It was put in front of me and I just found myself so captured by it, just not only because of the big words that you use, but funny enough, the relatability. I didn't find myself unable to understand the book altogether. So one thing I want to know is, why did you go for this particular title? I mean, we know that this is a sequel to your first book, which is Lift As You Rise, Speeches and Thoughts on Leadership, which is very straightforward. But now you said Behold the Turtle. Why did you go for that title, and why did you write this book in this particular moment in time?
It's an African adage that says in full, behold the turtle, comma, it only makes progress when its neck is stuck out. It says we all begin to die when we are silent about things that genuinely matter. It says, imagine if the good people spend as much time, energy, and effort as the bad guys. Where would you be? It picks up from the late emeritus Mpilo Desmond Tutu when he says, when you choose neutrality, actually, you choose the side of the oppressor. Therefore, imagine where the world would be if all of us had no fear of retributions or reprisals, when we feel needed and wanted, when we feel free to speak our mind. So Behold the Turtle says, is it possible that Africa can be ethically principled leadership? Which sounds tautologous, because ethical leadership can be anything else other than ethical. But for emphasis, we say ethical leadership.
Right.
As opposed to those who call themselves our leaders. And this is where I think they got wrong. And we got it wrong. Because they spent 27 years in Robben Island, we actually thought that they're incorrigible, therefore incorruptible. And yet our brethren and compatriots in the rest of the continent told us, hey, South Africa, wait, you haven't learned out of the other 54 African countries, starting from Ghana that became free in 1957. Because three things you need to learn. One is that these Uhuru presidents that stay in power for 40 odd years are not good for Africans. Secondly, they said, even the good guys left on their own eventually become the bad guys. Lastly, it says you need a robust, viable opposition to keep the good guys in check. Therefore, the arrogance, the impunity of this ANC-led government stems from that. Some of them even articulated it to say, no, don't worry, we'll eat as much as we want, like pigs feeding from the trough, because we'll rule until Jesus come. And did Jesus come quickly?
We're still waiting.
Well, I mean, in the meantime, you know, Lebang refers to your book and she says that she found it, you know, really, really thoughtful, and you did say the word, it was accessible to you as
relatable,
well. But you know, there's something else about your book, and there's something else about all the speeches, and I've seen you make many speeches at various events where all the good and the great and the glorious are seated there listening to you, and they listen very carefully to what you say, because there's another aspect to what you do, and you do this in the book, is you confront the problems head on. You're not trying to obfuscate. You've obviously been in business for a long time. You've also been in academia. You're not the kind of person who turns a blind eye to things. If something is true, you address it. That's very difficult. Most politicians aren't capable of that, and thank God you're not a politician. But Prof, we have to own up to some serious problems, and you've already outlined what state capture has done to us. But there are many other things that we can start to do to right the wrongs of the last 27 years, because those 27 years should have been spent righting the wrongs of the previous administrations. You know, the regime that came before, which did us all this enormous disservice. So what do you think we can do as ordinary citizens now? What can Lebang and me and everybody else who's listening to this do now to be a part of the solution?
Because we are in the throes of the lowest levels of confidence, trust, and hope since the Second World War, I think we need to start by reminding ourselves that we were once good. We were once global. were excellent. We took the Department of Finance expenditure and created a revenue service called SARS that became amongst the top five in the world. We had men and women in national treasury that could pound for pound stand with other national treasuries anywhere else in the world.
In fact, we ran at a surplus when we had a president called Thabo Mbeki and a minister of finance called Trevor Manuel, did we not?
The longest serving finance minister. In fact, President Thabo Mbeki, we say he served 5+5. We forget that he served the three of Rolihlahla Nelson Mandela's 5-year term because he was really in charge. And he gave us 43 consecutive quarters of positive GDP growth. And when that happened, we reached the zenith, which was 5.6% GDP growth in December of 2007. And ever since then, we have never touched those levels again. So I think what really needs to be done, let me start with the good news, to remind ourselves that we are really God's own children. This is God's own country, blue skies, African sunshine. The things that we've been able to do in the midst of the 9 wasted years. Just now, with the almost 4 years that President Matamela, Cyril Ramaphosa, has been in office, but not yet in power, one, SAA has been semi-privatized. Those who from Labour must listen to the West carefully, privatized, because privatization is not a swear word. Secondly, municipalities can now procure electricity from sources other than Eskom. Thirdly, even companies can now self-generate their own electricity up to 100 megawatts, when before then it was 1, and we were praying for 5, and he gave us 100. He needs to remember the decision he took against his own party and move ahead with confidence, because he's on the right path. Lastly, Transnet, and in particular the Durban port, is the third from the bottom. Now, the whole of which is the backbone of our infrastructure, now accept this notion of public-private partnerships. And it says, private sector, come and show us your expertise, invest your own hard-earned money, for which you will get your own internal rate of return, but also return on investment. You know why? Because the private sector is the only one that can deliver this notion called project management, deliver mega projects on time, on budget, and in full. When governments all over, including this government, Midupi Kusile Ingul, from the new multi-product pipeline, budgeted at $7 billion, landed and finally delivered 4 times the duration at $27 billion. Midupi was $30 billion, it went to $54 billion. And the scene there was the ANC-led government had its own private company, Chancellor House, that owned a stake in Hitachi that was providing the boilers. So 20% of 30 billion is okay, but 20% of 54 billion. So you can see that there was a perverse incentive, especially a party that can pay its own employees at Lituli House, that used to have close to 400 MPs in 1994. Now, the last, not the first of November 2021 local government elections, but the very first, where they got probably 51.6%. When you get that, you retrench the stuff that you had, that you thought was going to rule until Jesus came. They kept all of them. Now, they stopped paying them October, November, December. Yeah. That's why the hurry, the agency to sign this contract with Prasa, so that they can lease these trains, even though there are no tracks on which it will run. There is no electricity overhead. But as long as we sign the contract, we give them tenants, whatever it is, we can bank the 200 million, which is a bribe. Then it allows us to go and pay. So when we thought that state capture went with former President Jacob Zuma, I think South Africans, let's wake up and realize that state capture is still happening as we speak. We saw that with PPE. We saw that with the announcement of the 500 billion South African rands socioeconomic stimulus as a response to the pandemic.
You know, Bonang, the fact that you've been at Business Unity South Africa and that it represents such an enormous swathe of our economy, and there are all kinds of organizations that are represented in BUSA, business is very often portrayed as the villain in many of the stories. You know, it suits government to say, oh, we may be corrupt, but look, business is also corrupt. And of course, you know, the one hand does wash the other, and if those hands are both dirty, then they both get dirty. You know, if one of them is dirty, they both get dirty. But basically, business is is a force, just like government, when used properly, for good. Mm. It's the central backbone of the economy. Private enterprise is hugely important because it employs people, it creates the value, delivers the products, it makes the whole society work. And small business in particular, which probably isn't as well represented when government come to the table as big business are, have also had to carry the can over these two very difficult years of COVID. So how are you feeling business is doing? And do you think it's fair that business is so often cast as an equal villain with government in the state capture stuff?
So it breaks my heart personally. It breaks Busa's heart as the apex organization of 55 other organizations that the Deputy Chief Justice Raymond Zondo's report, number one of three, that came in three volumes. The first volume deals rightly with South African Airways and its associated companies. So South African Airways Technical, South African Express Airways, and then, of course, Air Chefs, the catering company. The second volume deals with the New Age. I mean, this is amazing vehicle. Sure. One of 55 web of intricacies created by the Guptas to obfuscate where the money is going. Mm. The third volume deals, of course, with the capture of the South African Revenue Service. It breaks my heart that it's always the few that then taints the rest of us. You need only one rotten potato and the whole bag will be rotten if we don't act. So the companies that were named, and the Zondo Commission report has some choice words for this business. And it talks about Nedbank, it talks about PwC, Standard Bank, and Bain, and others. So we have said to our members who these companies belong to, make sure that you have some critical, courageous, but nonetheless crucial conversations about what happened. They must take you into their confidence. What was their role in aiding and abetting state capture? But most importantly, what do they do to make sure that it doesn't happen again? Because you see, if you're a good CEO, you know that, like Steinhoff, when so much money has been stolen, it's a failure of the system of a company, not one rotten individual. Because alone, you cannot bribe the whole organization.
Right.
You need a whole gang, absolutely a school, so that when you write that invoice, somebody signs it off and the money comes and then another one banks it. So there is nothing more critical in our role as leaders that we can do than, out of the four things that we are charged to do, the most critical is culture. When that happens, you need to ask ourselves as a company to say, what type of culture allowed this to happen? The same way that when you talk about what gives us comfort at the board, we say it's the notion of risk management. We say it's the issue of compliance. We say it's group internal audit. And if you are in financial services, we say it's actuarial services. It's like a cheese, a Swiss cheese model. If it goes through one hole, the second catches it. If it goes through two, the third, the fourth. That's what makes us sleep at night. Therefore, it's inconceivable that we can say, no, you see, the two executives that did the state capture are now gone, we fired them, now we can move on. The good example is Siemens, that was found to have been engaged in things that they shouldn't in 2006, 15 years ago. They've gone through a 10-year process to say, how do we change the culture where every single soul to one of our employees feel free to speak their mind? How do we post everywhere, in the loos, in the photocopy machines, to say, actually, we encourage you, when you see something, please phone this number. You can be anonymous. But the culture that says, this is as much your company as it belongs to Siemens. So when you steal from it, even if it's a photocopying paper, is the culture that we don't want.
Yeah.
We look at our systems and processes to see that they've happened. You know, as I conclude, there are four other critical things that you do as a good CEO, not just a CEO. This is the stuff of leadership. Number one is you put your people first. The ANC leaders have put themselves first.
Yeah.
They don't mind stealing PPE to the value of 2/3 of the 500 billion. In Gauteng, we know that 2/3 went to 127 companies that were created on the 29th of March when this was going to be the effective on the 1st of April. So you can see it was well thought out, agitated, and orchestrated. The second one is this notion of HSSE. And again, it deals with people. It's an acronym for health, safety, security, and environment. The third, it's reputation management. Because if you lose that, it's very difficult to regain it. You lose it in 20 seconds, it takes you 20 years to build it back. And Siemens understands that. The last, of course, is stakeholder management. How you engage, interact, and interface with anybody that is likely to have an impact on your business. Those are called your stakeholders. So of all those things, we need to go back and say, as business, we have lost our reputation, we have lost our integrity, and we have lost, in fact, our own credibility, which we had worked so hard to build up from the Yes campaign. We had worked hard during the Business Trust, where we raised R1 billion. We had lost it when we created the RDP fund to say we're going to focus on tourism and the training related to tourism. We have lost that goodwill that we built by creating the Solidarity Fund, 5 billion pledged. After only a week, we banked 2.3 billion and used it for the vaccine rollout to manage this pandemic. All that goodwill work now taints all of us with a bad brush. So we will have to redouble our efforts, work that much harder, because, as I conclude, when business does well, society generally does well. Mm-hmm. Business cannot continue to be an island of poverty, of prosperity in a sea of poverty. Right. You can't live in Alexander, 2 kilometers away from the richest square mile in the continent, and you walk there every day, and yet your immediate supervisor and the bosses have never been to Alexander, and we claim to love you, because there's an African adage that says you have to love your people in order to lead them.
100%. And this is something you speak about almost in every single chapter in your book, that the value of people, the people you work with, the people you interact with, people is the real currency. And a part of that is living a life of purpose and meaning. Now, this, I was trying to wrap my head around it, because it's easy to sometimes say, you know, you need to live a life of purpose, meaning, and so on and so forth. But if you can't attain it, then it's difficult for you. So how would you advise the average South African out there who's struggling, who's suffering, or whatever the case is, to, you know, try their best to live that life of purpose and meaning?
So number one, the reason why you put people first is because my grandmother used to say, isn't it funny that those people that wake up in the morning chasing money hardly have any, but those that follow their passion, they make money until it comes out of their ears. Therefore, it was...
Why is that? It seems unfair.
Yes.
It seems so wrong.
Yes. So you have to focus on the right things. So let me come back to the issues of business. We want embarrassingly good results. That's at the pinnacle. But you can't have those unless you build a foundation of trust. Second layer, you invite conflict. Third layer, you commit to action. The fourth layer, you hold people finally accountable. If you do those four in that order, the logical outcome is results. Therefore, if you want to make money, you become Tiger Woods. You play golf even if you are not paid for it, because you do it because you just love it.
Yeah.
So in business, we are taught that you must do what you love and love what you do. Many people come 8 to 5. They absolutely hate the people they work with. As they wake up in the morning, their energy is already dejected. And they come into the office and they exude this. But look at the people that follow their purpose. They say, this company does things that are congruent, that are consistent, that resonate with who I am and my own values. In fact, young people teach us today, they don't go for Coca-Cola and Procter & Gamble and Unilever. They say, I want to work for a company that I can relate to. I choose the company. We are just lucky to have a job. And they look at a supervisor and they say, can this supervisor genuinely, deeply, and profoundly connect with me? Because people join companies, but they leave supervisors.
But Prof, even what you're saying now is a deeper social thing than it is just getting a job or working for a company. What you're talking about, these values and this purpose and meaning, where do we teach our young people this? Some of us are fortunate. We've grown up in families where these things are taught to us at an early age. Some of us learn at university or at school, maybe by the wayside. Maybe we have an elder in the family who sits us down and explains to us how things work. But you have this ability to make sense of this and to speak about it with such authority. Where did you learn this, and how do we imbue this into young people?
Because I stood at the knees of amazing good quality leaders. I have been in the presence of dignified greatness from the black pool of excellence. I've worked with the late Maduke Lord Ndlovu. I have been tutored by Professor Lumkile Wiseman Nkuhlu. I engage, interact, and interface on an ongoing basis with Dr. Ruel Khoza, who is the epitome of ethical leadership. We asked him more than 7 times to be the president of the BMF. Every single time he said, no, I prefer to be in the background. So he's one of the presidents we've never had, but we treat him like one of the people who have actually been our president. He's generous and he gives of himself and what he knows, because he understands that when you give money, you give a lot. When you give time, you give much. But when you give of yourself, you give everything.
Yeah.
And he's given us everything.
And to teach these children, because they don't have access to these amazing people that you have. Some of them may hear this podcast now and hear you, and you may be one of those voices for the next generation. But where can we teach them these things?
So by doing what you are doing, that's why I think what you're doing is truly, genuinely amazing, because it goes to those spaces where it would take us long to touch.
Mm-hmm.
But secondly, it's about saying, but we had role models, we lived with them. Now all of us, when we make money, the first thing we do out of safety, we go to the suburbs. And the ones that remain behind, their role models becomes amakinsa, people who steal cars, the people who rob cash in transit. The guy was broke on Tuesday. Friday, he's buying beers for the whole shebeen and he's driving a red BMW X5M with white leather. Nobody asks, but where did you get this? Because we have kind of condoned it. Lastly, here's one that's very profound. The reason why the National Party survived for such a long time, not just the 48 years of apartheid, the 98 years of separate development, the 350 years of colonialism, it's because they expected their leaders to take their own children to the same schools in the world where they are, so that they can pick up when something is wrong. When they were ill, they were expected to go to the same hospitals. And indeed, when somebody jumped the fence, they called the same SAPS. Now what we have is the middle class have discovered medical aid, which is private medical health. They have private security, 550,000 against the SAPS, which is 150,000. They use courier companies, not SAPS. So education, they use private education, Crawford College, Benmore Gardens, instead of going to the public education. As I conclude, I think the way it manifests is where we are now. It's genuinely a spot of bother, because we're holding the world record for all the wrong reasons. The most unequal society in the world, the country with the most highest unemployment in the world, the highest SME failure rate in the world. We have the second highest levels of suicide rates after Russia. And I already said, you know, we are the third bottom in terms of just our infrastructure, the port of Durban. And how it manifests is you see, number one, that this inequality is actually increasing and widening. Racism is at an all-time high. But black graduates are roaming the streets hopelessly.
Or leaving if they can to other countries where they can find
jobs. You are
the
family's only hope. They sold their cattle from Limpopo to take you to the University of Fort Hare or Terfloop. And now you come and you're standing at the street corners with a board that says, I'm a qualified engineer, I did this, and please call this number. So this is hopelessness. But also, at the time that public education has collapsed, public healthcare continue to fail the poor and the vulnerable. But crucial infrastructure is lying in decay, and lawlessness has now become an epidemic. If you rob a bank, you've got an 80% chance of getting away with it. So I think three things we need to do, because all of us collectively have not succeeded in eradicating the legacy of apartheid. Number one, we must grow this economy, because if you don't grow the economy, you'll be talking about the redistribution of poverty, not wealth. Number two, we must create jobs in large numbers. Because when business creates jobs, it's not in and of itself, you are creating markets of the future. Lastly, we need to transform. When you go to China, India, and Japan, those economies and those countries look typically Japanese, Chinese, and Indian. except South Africa looks like an outpost of Europe. Therefore, we must be broadly reflective of the demographics. Women are 51% of the 60.1 million South Africans. Black people are 90% of the population. White people are 8.3% of the population. And yet, when you look at the C-suite, 70% is white male Afrikaners.
Yeah.
Women, at the very best, 24% of positions of leadership. African women, 4%. When young people of military age are sitting at home, twiddling their thumbs with nothing to do.
Ooh,
not only are you asking for trouble, you are actually actively inviting it. Thank you for having me. It's been an amazing conversation.
Sure.
Lebang.
There's so many things I want to ask, but the one that's sticking on my mind is this concept of the new normal versus the better normal. I mean, the first thing you said when you walked into the office today was, have you been vaccinated? I mean, the COVID really did, you know, change our lives in that way that now it's just a part of our lives. It's what we do. So please, can you explain this concept of the new normal versus the better normal very quickly?
So the Americans say, how can we build back better? As South Africans, we need to say there's no point in hankering towards a better future or crying about the past that we used to have. It's about saying not really a new normal, but a better normal. Because when your house has burned down, you can build the same house, but actually you're not moving forward. You say, let me take the insurance money, now design the house based on my needs. Mm. And the needs of South Africans are simple. They are simply saying the 16 million South Africans that are gainfully employed, and yet 17 million people who are on social security. Mm. The math doesn't add up.
No.
This is pre-COVID. So when we open up to say, we'll give you 350 a month social relief grant, 14 million people apply. We give to 11 million. You add to 17, that's 28 million. And the people who are still paying the bill is 16 million. You can see it's a powder keg. It's a time bomb that is waiting to go off.
Yeah.
There is 10 million young people who are not in education, employment, or training. There is 6 million young people who don't know their father. Only 30% of South African households have both a father and a mother. Therefore, we must accept that we are a troubled, broken people, that the violence of apartheid and the violence of anti-apartheid movement and the violence that we've enjoyed during the black-on-black violence of Inkatha versus ANC in the Kathoras region has left deep and profound scars.
Mm.
To heal those, we begin to look at each other and one another in the eye to say, how do we as a nation give effect to the South Africa of Kholihlahla Nelson Mandela's dreams to bring about this notion of a South Africa we have all been praying for, of nation building, of social cohesion. Mm. Because when we can have 10 red and we keep 4 for ourselves, we use 6 to lift as we rise the others.
Yes.
We can then sleep at night. I conclude by saying, when your neighbor is hungry, you are the one that can sleep at night.
Very profound. And as always, you are just one of the most inspiring people. Please continue to do the good work that you do and keep writing your books. 2 bestsellers already. And I don't know if that's what you set out to do, but it's certainly something you deserve. Professor Bonang Mohale, and it's a great pleasure to have you on This Is Us today. Thank you.
Thank you. CliffCentral.com.